Live from KCUR News, this is Casey Currents on Central Standard, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. The popularity of locally grown and raised food in Kansas City continues to rise, but it can be difficult for small farmers in the region to produce enough for a whole restaurant or grocery store. That's why food hubs are taking off around the country. Today on Casey Currents, we talked to some people who are trying to bring the food hub concept to Kansas City.
For those who are willing maybe to pay a little bit more for food that comes from close by, that infrastructure is lacking, but it's growing fast.
And we remember a Topeka woman who started one of the first all-female mariachi groups in the country.
And the women especially, they said, oh, that is good for you, for a woman to be playing.
It's Casey Currents. Listen up just after this news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Welcome to Casey Currents. We use stories and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. A lot of local restaurants have been trying to get more of their ingredients from local farmers. The same with grocery stores. But it can be hard to get enough product from any one farm to make that feasible. To deal with that and some of the other challenges in the local food movement, a new kind of food hub is popping up across the country. These food processing and distribution centers make it easier for restaurants, grocery stores, and others to buy local food. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says there are more than 220 of them in 40 states. In a few minutes, we'll hear about a local attempt to start up a food hub here in Kansas City. And we want to hear thoughts about what would make local food more accessible to you. Call 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. But first, Sean Powers reports from Illinois for Harvest Public Media. There, he finds food hubs are a trend that are not only helping struggling farms, but also bringing new talent to agriculture.
Max! Pick, pick, pick! Come on, Max!
Donna O'Shaughnessy and her husband are first-generation farmers in rural Chatsworth, Illinois, about 2 hours south of Chicago. They sell dairy and meat. O'Shaughnessy was a full-time nurse for many years while her husband focused on the farm. They ended each year in the red, but about 5 years ago, business took off, with restaurant owners as far away as Chicago putting in order requests.
For years, we did not think we could ever be totally sustainable, that we would always need my nursing income. But then when things really started to pick up with us, we made that decision I would retire from nursing. And ironically, that's when we started to turn a profit because I was able to do the marketing.
And her husband focused on other tasks on the farm. This was all possible because they joined a year-round food hub called Stewards of the Land, started in 2005 by this guy.
Peppermint, borage flowers,
radish pods.
That should be it.
It's a little after 6 o'clock on a recent morning in the nearby town of Fairbury. Marty Travis and his son Will load a van with roughly 1,500 pounds of food from about a dozen area farmers, who filled a walk-in cooler the night before with fruits and vegetables, poultry and meat, and grains and flour. In about an hour, Travis drives the shipment to restaurants and grocery stores throughout central Illinois and Chicago. Basically, he's the middleman. A farmer himself, he took on this role to fill a hole in the market.
So as we go, we can incubate these farms and get them on their feet to do their own things.
Travis and his wife founded this food hub and started a second one a few years later. Members include about 40 small family farmers who pay a small fee to join. Travis says they get cheaper liability insurance, access to a much larger pool of businesses, and farmer training.
I would say the new generation farmers are a little over half of the group. Many of them were under the age of 18 when they joined. We're very interested in growing great produce, but we're also very, very passionate about growing farmers.
One up-and-coming farmer is 15-year-old Derek Stoller of Fairbury. He joined Stewards of the Land when he was 9 years old and growing Indian corn. Since then, working in his parents' backyard and putting his family to work, he's moved on to other things like beets, parsley, and carrots.
Last year I grossed around 15,000.
What's probably the most exciting thing you've learned about this sort of work?
That you can grow off of a little patch of land and make a lot of money off of it.
we recognize that there is significant opportunity for small entrepreneurs.
That's Doug O'Brien, the USDA's acting undersecretary of rural development.
For those who are willing maybe to pay a little bit more for food that comes from close by, that infrastructure is lacking, but it's growing fast. Food hubs respond to that call.
The USDA recently awarded a nearly $100,000 grant to set up 3 food hubs in central Illinois. One of the people behind that effort is Tara Brockman. She estimates the region loses about $5 billion annually because money is spent on food and agricultural inputs from outside the area.
It used to be that when we talked about rural development, we talked about prisons and factories. And, you know, we're finally at the point where it's like, hey, look around in Illinois. When you're talking rural, you're talking farming, particularly this kind of small farming, direct marketed, feed your community kind of farming, where the money does stay and circulate within your community.
O'Brien expects the USDA to continue supporting food hubs, though some farmers worry that could lead to more regulations, even with federal support. But at least for now, that doesn't appear to be keeping food hubs from growing. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Sean Powers in Urbana, Illinois.
And that food hub trend has come to Kansas City. Here in the studio, we have a couple of people who can tell us about these new networks that are supporting small farmers in the region. Emily Miller is the local project coordinator for the Greater KC Food Hub Working Group. She works for BNIM, the architecture and planning firm. Thanks for joining us, Emily.
Thanks, Sylvia. Great to be here.
And Katie Nixon is a small farm specialist with Lincoln University Cooperative Extension. She and her husband also run Green Gate Family Farm in Wheatland, Missouri. Thanks for driving out here on this snowy day.
Oh, no problem.
So, Katie, tell me, what do you grow?
Well, we grow a variety of produce, including fruits, vegetables, and we also have an organic poultry operation. So we do eggs, goose, duck, and chicken eggs.
So are you part of a food hub right now?
We are not. The Greater Kansas City Food Hub Working Group is just in the process of doing a feasibility study. So there are a couple operating food hubs in the greater region, but we are not part of them.
And what have you seen as a small farmer is kind of the need for these kind of hubs?
Well, we live 2 hours away from Kansas City, and that's our prime market for organic produce to be able to get the premium price that is required for the amount of time and labor that it takes to grow that food. So for us, it's about getting our product to market and not having to spend so much time on the marketing aspect of things so we can grow more food. Mm. So that's the biggest issue for us. One of the big issues for us is just trying to find the markets and not have to run around to every restaurant and ask them and be denied to half the restaurants, because it's kind of, you know, demoralizing when you cold call a restaurant and they say, no, we don't want anything, thanks. You know, so.
Is it partly the cost of transportation and what that adds to the cost of the food?
That's definitely part of it. And the time. I mean, you only have so much time in the day, and it takes a lot of time to grow food and also to market and to run a business and to do everything else that it requires to be successful. So.
And would most restaurants want more or less than you are offering?
Well, it depends. There are groups of restaurants in Kansas City that'll buy for all of their restaurants, and those are real good restaurants to get involved with because they'll buy more. But sometimes a small restaurant, it's almost not worth the delivery, you know, based on the low amount that they buy. Where the food hub comes in really is to help aggregate produce for institutions, and I guess we'll talk about that a little later, but that's kind of where the scale comes in.
And so, Emily, tell us, where does the need come from the institutional or perspective of restaurants or stores?
So there's a lot of institutions that are really wanting to buy more local produce. Children's Mercy Hospital, St. Luke's Hospital, and several schools in our metro area are purchasing more local produce, and they want to be able to buy more. But there are challenges with the systems that they use for purchasing and preparing food that make it difficult to buy directly from lots of different farmers.
It's interesting just because that basic idea, I kind of understand why restaurants and stores are interested in local food, because it seems like the consumer is directly. But I don't know as much why institutions are interested in purchasing local food, because it seems like it might not really be part of their mission. I see why a hospital or a school might want to serve healthy food, but why local?
I think that it's becoming more and more a part of their mission, that they want to support the local economy, the local producers, and get food that's coming through a values-based supply chain.
But the challenge is that it would be at a greater cost that, let's say, for a hospital that would come out of or be added to what people are paying for their operations or their services at the hospital.
Right. That is one of the challenges. And price is one of the challenges for producers as well. So the idea with a food hub is that scaling up production and buying larger volumes can afford a little bit of a lower price for an institutional volume of purchasing, but can also support the producer in the value of the time that they put into producing that food.
So what exists in Kansas City right now in terms of these kind of networks for small farmers to distribute their food?
There is a food hub, Good Natured Family Farms, that is purchasing from 150 farmers in the region, and they sell through Ball's Food Store. There are some local distribution companies that are scaling up and gearing up their local programs. C&C Produce is an example. There's a lot of growing interest in other food hub initiatives because there's so much demand from different institutions. And so we are working with several different initiatives that are working towards food hub infrastructure, including one in Douglas County that's doing a feasibility study. We've partnered with them. Mm-hmm. There's a few others in Kansas City that are working to develop that infrastructure.
And in terms of those existing ones, you mentioned Good Natured mm-hmm. Family Farms that mm-hmm. works with Ball Family Foods, that is the hen houses. Mm-hmm. Are they a private company? Are they nonprofit? Are they cooperative?
They work as both, and they're private businesses selling to Ball's Foods, but they also have they work with a nonprofit agency as a fiscal agent to do some of their farm-to-school programs and other community benefit programs.
I see. And are most food hubs that we're talking about nonprofit, or most of them private?
You know, they have varied organizational structures. There is a food hub in Philadelphia called Common Market. They have a nonprofit structure, and they purchase from 75 different producers and sell to 150 institutions in Philadelphia. And then there's Abe and Jake's, which is in New Orleans. That's a private business, and they're selling online and delivering, and they're opening up a retail facility. So it can take a lot of different forms, a food hub.
And Katie, how did you get involved in this feasibility study and working group on food stuff?
Well, actually, it's been a long time. We've been working on this for almost 2 years, and actually over 2 years now. But I work as a small farm specialist, like you mentioned earlier in the program, for Lincoln University Cooperative Extension. And we have an innovative small farmers outreach program. So I work with about 30 farmers in the region, but our program in the West Central region works with about 150 farmers. And there's a constant theme for farmers that they have trouble marketing. And farmers markets are great, and they're a wonderful place, and the food hub would never be competing with that kind of a market. But there is another market out there that's not being met. And for those small farmers who have sort of maxed out their capacity at a farmers market of about the amount of money that they can make and want to scale up, there's only so many farmers markets you can go to and make the money that you want to make. So the need came out of them being able to find another market to go to so that they would have a place to sell their produce, a consistent place to sell their produce for my clients.
And Emily, so who is really spearheading? Is this effort coming from the farmers or coming from the institutions or coming from another organization?
I think what's great about the working group is that it represents so many different disciplines and sectors. So of the 14 organizations that are part of this working group, KC Healthy Kids and the Greater Kansas City Food Policy Coalition is working on policy systems and environmental change. KD's Extension Agency, K-State Extension, MU Extension represent producer perspective. There's also organizations that represent logistical networking, software networking, and then others who represent the institutional perspective, like the Independent School District.
Interesting. You're listening to Casey Currents on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We're talking about food hubs today, new distribution networks for local food, with Emily Miller of the Greater Casey Food Hub Working Group and Katie Nixon, who's also working with the working group and a small farm extension specialist with Lincoln University. I'm wondering about, you're doing a feasibility study right now. Where are you in that? And what are you finding about the feasibility of creating new networks?
So right now we're conducting a survey of both producers and buyers to identify what their needs are for the services of a food hub and what the barriers are to selling to or purchasing from a food hub. We're doing that because we really want to understand what the existing conditions are in our region and what the needs are so that we can design a food hub that fills the gap and also meets those needs. So we're doing a survey across the region, and then we'll follow that up with interviews and then a meeting where we bring buyers and growers together to talk about some of those barriers. We're also working to understand what the existing infrastructure is in Kansas City so that we're complementing that. And then we're working with many partners across the region to do outreach so that we can test and we're also testing a networked model to see how we can integrate some of the existing food hub initiatives that are happening in Kansas City.
And how large is the region?
We're looking at a radius of 250 miles. That's basically defined because it's the distance that you could drive in a day to deliver food to a food hub or to take food from a food hub somewhere else.
Kansas City, what would make local food more accessible to you? Do you make a point of buying local food, even if you have to pay more? Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us at kccurrents@kcur.org. I understand the story we heard at the top of the show. Sean Powers reported that some food hubs are also providing education to farmers. Mm-hmm. I wonder if... Katie, do you see a need for that, too?
Yeah, working in extension, you know, I think our extension programs in Kansas City are really fantastic, and as well as some nonprofits like Cultivate Kansas City, who is also part of the working group. Mm-hmm. But all the extension services and the nonprofits, they give great workshops, very affordable workshops, and that infrastructure is there. And so we decided when we put the money towards the feasibility study what we were going to look for, because we couldn't do everything and we didn't need to do everything, because we know that the infrastructure for education is there and that the extension services will respond to what needs to be taught. So we're really looking at the physical setup of the food hub rather than also the educational aspect, because we know those partnerships are already there.
Interesting. And I had been thinking about how many extension programs and Cultivate KC mm-hmm. that does so much with small farmers. Then what does this physically look like? Is it a bunch of trucks? Is it a distribution center, like a warehouse or something like that?
That's a great question.
Yeah, that is the question that we're researching now. And we'll know, based on what we learn from producers and institutions, what that model should be. When I mentioned that we're looking at a networked model, it's because we've identified already through our research with partners that there are clusters of production and purchasing activity that are happening around the region. And so we're testing to see if it's possible to have a few facilities, whether they be something like regional packing facilities where producers don't drive as far to drop off their product, and then the product is aggregated there and maybe shipped into a central facility, or shipped between multiple facilities that may be working together by using the same software or maybe using the same trucking infrastructure. There are a lot of different forms that it can take, and that's why this feasibility study is so important, so that we are not creating, reinventing the wheel here in Kansas City, really helping to meet the demand that is unmet.
We're in a good position, too, because there are, what did he say, 250 food hubs around the country who have all these different models. So we can learn from those.
Yeah.
And we've gotten some good advice about, you know, utilizing what's already there, not building these really fancy, you know, central structures that aren't used properly and spend a lot of money on building them. So trying to use what's there and making sure that we're not doing something that's not going to be not going to work.
And Emily Miller, is it different from larger food distributors? I mean, why aren't those companies just stepping in and doing this for local farmers?
Well, there are some local distribution companies that are doing that, like CNC Produce is ramping up their local purchasing program. And then there are some larger companies like Sysco. It has a local purchasing program. Their definition of local is a much broader scale than we define it. But there's just not as much activity happening on that broadline distributor level.
I'd also like to say that we really I mean, I want to see farmers coming out of the woodwork to be part of the food hub.
Yeah.
And it would be a farmer-driven food hub, because that's when the choices that are made from the top level of the food hub, if that's how it's structured, if it's not a cooperative, you know, they will be made by the farmers themselves that are selling to the food hub. And
yeah,
that is the biggest difference, that they're driving their own markets.
Yeah.
And not being told what the price is.
Right. As we mentioned, fair prices for farmers is one of the most important issues for this food hub. And when farmers are part of creation and operation of the food hub, then they get to help determine what those prices are.
And we're asking you in our audience, are you a small farmer looking for better ways to distribute your foods? Tell us what your needs from a food hub would be. Call 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We're also on Twitter at Casey Currents. So in terms of price, I wonder how much can having a food hub lower the cost of to the consumer or to the institution or restaurant of the product?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, really, what's going to drive the price are going to be eventually the terminal market price from the USDA, which you can find every day. There's a terminal market price for all the vegetables produced in the country.
What does that mean?
The terminal market price is what the cost of the produce was when it came to the market where the wholesalers buy it. So from the farm to the wholesaler, that's the terminal market price. Basically, there have been some surveys, like one done, I believe it was in Warrensburg, to some institutional buyers about, you know, how much extra would you pay for local food above the terminal market price? And it was about 10 to 15% they would pay extra. So that's kind of how you're going to figure out costs. And you're also just going to have a conversation, too, which is why the buyer-grower meeting is going to be really important that we do with the feasibility study.
And what do you see from institutions, Emily?
In terms of price,
like how much more would they be willing to pay to get on the local food bandwagon? You say that they're interested, they want to,
right,
but they can't spend much more, I would imagine, than they're already spending buying from a regular distributor that gets, you know, carrots from wherever.
Yeah, that's true. And we're still learning about that. And that's part of why buyer participation in the research and the survey that's out right now is so important. That's an online survey. So any buyers that are listening to the show could access the survey and provide their input and tell us what it is that they're willing to pay. You know, there are in farm to school programs, there are certainly price limitations that schools run up against in what they can pay. And so we need to learn a lot more about what that price flexibility is for schools and institutions.
I also want to say that institutions are not just paying for a local product. The local products, there's more area room for quality control, I believe, because there's less travel time.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there was a huge issue with tomatoes a couple of years ago, and they were coming in from California, and half of them were rotten when they got there. And, you know, they can not accept those truckloads of food and send them back, but that's just food wasted. So I think there's a benefit to institutions buying locally. They're getting better quality control from a food hub.
And do food hubs help out also with some of the food safety accreditation and all of that?
So they could.
Yeah.
And for example, Good Natured Family Farms is doing group GAP certification. GAP certification is what's required to have good agricultural practices to sell to institutions. A lot of institutions are requiring that. A food hub can operate to support farmers in coming together to do certifications like that.
We have a caller here from Eudora, Kansas. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
Yes, well, thank you for taking my call. I was just talking about how with the older people in our population like me, we live in a lot of these senior housing complexes. Some have gardens where we can feed ourselves and get ourselves off food stamps and away from these food distribution places. A lot of the food that is given to these food banks isn't so bad. You know, I mean, there's so much corn syrup and sugar and overly processed food. And I was wondering, you know, how could I go about getting the people who own these senior complexes to give us garden plots and maybe raised gardens for people who are in scooters, and, you know, the raised garden beds, and so we can feed ourselves again. A lot of us have been people who have studied.
Well, thank you, Nancy, for the question. I know that that's veering a little bit from food hubs, but I wonder if there's some programs that do help the elderly with having their own gardens.
Oh, definitely. In Kansas City, I don't know about you, Dora, but in Kansas City, we have the Kansas City Community Gardens, and they're an excellent organization that helps people with community gardens. We also do our small farm program, helps low-income people with community gardens. But I would say that our food hub does have a mission of trying to relieve some of the hunger in Kansas City, and we partner with the SOSA West, which is the gleaning operation here in Kansas City, the Society of St. Andrews gleaning operation, and they go out to farms and they glean product. So we're looking
at taking product that's left over. I think we've done some stories on them before, but after they've done the harvest, there's a lot still out in the
field. So we're talking about like what would the feasibility of a food hub operating and having two packing lines, one that goes to SOSA West and the other one that goes, you know, to our institutions. So that's a possible collaboration there to help.
Well, we have another call here from David. He called 816-235-2888. It's 816-235-2888. Hi, David.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. What's your question for our guests?
Yeah, my question for the guests is I teach a class called Local Foods at Johnson County Community College. And this was the first year that I'd heard of a food hub. And so I was very interested in it. And since I require my class to purchase their foods locally, I'm wondering when will the food hub be in operation? Because I would love it to be in operation by next year when I'm teaching this class next spring.
David, before we ask, I'm just curious, your students, are they coming to you? What's their interest in local foods?
Well, they are going to be chefs or they're going to be farmers. And so they're from Johnson County Community College, and then some of them want to be will be chefs, and some of them will be farmers.
Interesting. Well, so Emily, when do we expect to have sort of more food hubs or the outcome to your feasibility study in place here in Kansas City?
So our feasibility study is helping us determine the viability for more food hubs in the region. And so we will expect to know by July the recommendations for what kind of food hub we need and that and how that moves forward. If we get a go, if we decide that we need another food hub and want to move forward with a model, business planning can take anywhere from 3 months to a year. Probably the most likely startup timeframe would be early 2015.
And how would this change business? I understand, I know some farmers do CSAs, and community-supported agriculture, where they provide a box once a week to their clients or their customers who come to the farm or they have a drop-off spot. But they have to produce a lot of different types of produce in order to satisfy that. Would this change let farmers concentrate more on one kind of food?
We've been pretty clear that we don't want to compete with any markets that are already there. So CSA markets, there's a CSA coalition that helps farmers connect with customers connect with farmers and vice versa. And the food hub would not really get into CSAs or farmers markets, that just wouldn't be part of our market. However, the model of the food hub, if it becomes a farmer cooperative style, could be a model for a CSA, like a group CSA, like Rolling Prairie CSA in Kansas. They are several farmers that come together. They've been working together for decades, and they do a group CSA so that, you know, they don't have to grow every single thing that is for that CSA.
So in order to meet some of the barriers that producers are finding, investing in additional land, investing in equipment to scale up production, there needs to be additional dependable, trustworthy markets. And that's what a food hub can do through relationships with institutions like hospitals and schools. Some food hubs will sign contracts with institutions that commit to purchasing a certain amount of produce or something for the next year. And so food hubs can support farmers with crop planning services to help them scale up in a reasonable manner and help address some of those barriers. And when they're working in partnership with extensions and Cultivate and other organizations that are supporting farmer capacity, there's also other supports that help develop that capacity.
Can there sometimes be a disconnect between what farmers want to grow or know how to grow and what consumers want?
Of course. I mean, there's only so much eggplant you can eat, right?
Yeah.
So as a farmer, you have to sort of balance out what you like, but you also you need to respond to the market. So, you know, the insecurity of not like trying a new crop and not possibly growing it well or having too much of it and you over, you know, your market's just not there. The food hub can help farmers plan out like their risk and help them decide what they're going to grow and know that there's a steady market for them to sell to.
And part of what you talked about was also marketing and getting new institutions and new restaurants and new organizations interested in local food. Like, how do you make that case?
Well, so I think the Kansas City Food Policy Coalition has done a really excellent job of raising the profile of local food, and they have a Carrot Gold program where, and Emily, maybe you can speak a little bit more to this because I don't know all the details.
Mm-hmm. The Carrot Gold program is working right now with 10 partner institutions, including Children's Mercy, St. Luke's, Shawnee Mission Hospitals, also some restaurants. Hallmark is a partner in the program. And being part of the program, they commit to purchasing additional local foods. They start out with 5 items or 2%, and then they also commit to changing their food service and purchasing practices to be more sustainable. And the Carrot Gold program provides technical support, peer mentorship, and resources to help those institutions increase their buying. So they have the demand and the desire, and there's this infrastructure that's helping support to grow that.
Interesting. So there are some institutions already kind of signed on. Emily Miller is the local project coordinator for the Greater KC Food Working Group. She also works for BNIM. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
And Katie Nixon is a small farm specialist with Lincoln University Cooperative Extension. And she and her husband also run Green Gate Farm in Wheatland, Missouri. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Sylvia.
Coming up after the break, the story of a mariachi musician from Topeka whose career was almost cut short by a terrible accident. This is KC Currents. Welcome back to KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Missouri has put 2 people to death since last month, with another execution scheduled for late January. In this next segment, we hear from St. Louis Public Radio and The Beacon's Chris McDaniel and Veronique LaCapra. They've been looking into the state's secretive and controversial lethal injection process. They've discovered that the state may be ignoring its own laws in carrying out the death penalty.
At 10:52 on December 11th, inmate Alan Nicholson was pronounced dead. It was the state's second execution by lethal injection in 3 weeks, and it left numerous questions unanswered. As we've reported in previous months, a shortage of willing drug suppliers has led Missouri Governor Jay Nixon to direct the state to adopt a controversial new execution method.
Now the state is using a sedative, pentobarbital, that's also commonly used by veterinarians to euthanize animals. And the drug isn't made by a drug manufacturer, but by something called a compounding pharmacy, which mixes up the drug based on a specific request. Compounding pharmacies, like Missouri's execution drug supplier, aren't regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. These types of pharmacies are supposed to be regulated by the states. And as we've previously reported, the drugs they make are less likely to meet standards than drugs approved by the FDA. The execution drug's potency is critical. If the drug is too weak, or even not what it should be, it could result in a painful or slow death. And the U.S. Constitution is supposed to protect us from cruel and unusual punishment.
To complicate the issue, the state has fought hard to keep the identity of the supplier a secret, making it difficult to know if the state's execution method is both legal and ethical. The secrecy led a federal judge to declare that the state was getting its execution drug using a, quote, shadow pharmacy hidden by the hangman's hood. But by piecing together documents from dozens of public records requests, St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon has figured out that this shadow pharmacy is in Oklahoma, and it isn't licensed in Missouri. Under normal circumstances, selling a drug without a license could be a felony punishable by up to 7 years in prison.
And when you violate Missouri law in order to carry out Missouri law, that seems contradictory.
Tony Rothard is with the American Civil Liberties Union of Missouri, a group opposed to the death penalty. The ACLU has sued the state for keeping the supplier a secret. When we approached him with the information that the pharmacy isn't licensed,
it's not surprising, and that the state has gone to great lengths to hide what it's doing and to be secretive about what it's doing. So it's not surprising that there is something there that the state was trying to cover up.
The director of the Department of Corrections, George Lombardi, refused to comment for this story. But in a written statement, a department spokesperson said, quote, "The Department of Corrections complies with all laws relating to the acquisition of drugs used in executions."
We should point out that this pharmacy is licensed to do business in Oklahoma, but getting licensed in Missouri isn't just an administrative issue. It's the way the state maintains quality. Ned Milenkovich, a pharmacist and attorney who serves on the Illinois Board of Pharmacy, says the whole point of boards of pharmacy is to make sure that drugs are safe and effective.
The purpose of the board is not to protect the pharmacy and the pharmacist, but rather to protect the public of the state and the citizens of Missouri in this case.
Milenkovich says out-of-state pharmacies are legally required to be registered in the state they are shipping drugs to. Another expert we spoke to for this story, a former member of the Missouri Board of Pharmacy, agreed. But when we got into specifics on the legality of the Department of Corrections buying the drug for an execution, both the experts said they were unsure, that it was a gray area, that under these circumstances, the state might get to play by different rules. We asked the current members of the Missouri Board of Pharmacy whether they will be investigating the pharmacy for possibly breaking the law. They did not respond to our request for comment.
The legality of this specific situation is murky, but having an execution drug supplier not licensed by the Missouri Board of Pharmacy removes yet another layer of scrutiny in an already secretive process. As we've said before, the execution drug this Oklahoma pharmacy makes doesn't face oversight by the FDA, and if the Missouri Board of Pharmacy also isn't making sure the drug is what it claims to be, who is providing oversight?
Missouri is relying on another state to regulate the pharmacy and make sure its practices meet standards. We've tried to understand why the Department of Corrections would resort to using a pharmacy that isn't regulated in Missouri. One possibility is that the state thought the identity of the supplier wouldn't get out. They even changed the rules to try to make it illegal to name the pharmacy. Milenkovich, with the Illinois Board of Pharmacy, offered another possibility.
It could be the case that they can't find a pharmacy in Missouri to participate in this type of activity because, you know, when you take your oath of pharmacist practice or your oath of medicine, you know, a lot of people are, you know, for whatever reason, put off by the fact that they are going to be preparing a medication that is not going to be helpful for a person, not going to treat them, but rather is going to be used to put them to death.
Inmates are supposed to have the right to challenge the constitutionality of the state's method of execution. But in practice, Missouri has executed inmates before the courts have ruled on whether doing so violated their rights. A federal judge has criticized the state for treating executions like a game of chess, making changes to their methods and rushing to carry out lethal injections while the lawyers try to keep up. In court, Missouri Attorney General Chris Koster's office has repeatedly defended the state's execution process. His office asserts that the supplier should be kept secret, although they declined to comment for this story. The governor's office declined to comment as well, but in previous months, Nixon has defended the department's new secrecy.
I feel like the Department of Corrections has come up with an appropriate protocol that balances the need to do this ultimate punishment with making sure that we have as humane a way as possible to get it done.
The state of Missouri is basically saying, trust us.
Tony Rothard with the ACLU.
Everything that they've done with respect to the procuring of drugs and carrying out the death penalty in recent months has shown that we can't trust them. Instead, what they've shown is that they'll go to great lengths, breaking Missouri law, disobeying court orders in order to make sure the executions are carried out.
Missouri is scheduled to carry out its next execution in late January. That could be before the courts have time to decide if the state's new execution method is constitutional. I'm Veronique LaCapra.
And I'm Chris McDaniel.
Over the past few weeks here at KCUR, we've looked back at the lives of some local people whom we lost in 2013. But there's one we just heard about, a musical pioneer from Topeka. When she was already in her 60s, Teresa Cuevas started one of the first all-female mariachi bands in the country. And when her musical career was almost cut short by a historic accident in Kansas City, Cuevas found other ways to keep the mariachi tradition alive. We're going to listen back to a story we produced about Teresa Cuevas 5 years ago, and then hear from a new band that's dedicated to carrying on her music in a very different form. Mariachi is typically played by men, but in 1980, seven women from a church choir became a regional phenomenon, trading the traditional black pants for long maroon skirts. Mariachi Estrella was one of the first all-female mariachi bands in the country. They performed all over Kansas and had some unusual gigs, like serenading some National Guardsmen. 88-year-old Teresa Cuevas' eyes sparkle as she remembers.
We surrounded them and they didn't know what to do. They looked at each other and we kept just getting close to them and, you know, and singing, and we had a good time, and they didn't know how to, I don't know why, but they acted like they didn't know what to do.
And that's the novelty of, because usually, you know, men sing to women instead of the other way around.
And here that's, we were serenading them, and we were having a good time. Oh, I enjoyed it, and I'll never forget it as long as I live. That was something.
Teresa Cuevas was in her 50s back then, the oldest in a group of boisterous young women, and it meant something special to her. Teresa started playing classical violin when she was 8 years old. She got so good that in junior high, she was invited to play in the Topeka High School Symphony. But when she graduated in the 1930s, musical talent and good grades weren't enough for a young Latina to find a job beyond cleaning offices or sorting eggs.
I know I graduated with quite a number of girls, and I know I wasn't any dumber than they were, and they got the good jobs right away, but I couldn't get any.
So Teresa got married and had five children, but her relationship with her husband was troubled, and she says she wanted to make a name for herself. She started playing violin with the Our Lady of Guadalupe Choir.
The music was a part of me that made me feel like myself, like I used to feel, and that's what helped me to get over that. And I think I grew as a person because I had to get away from feeling that I was nothing.
By the time she was in her 50s, Teresa had divorced her husband, and with her fellow choir members, she found a new love. Band member Rachel Sangalang was 22 at the time.
We called it mariachi fever that we caught. It's mariachi fever. I guess you either love it or, you know, it just happened to strike a chord with us.
Their passion was contagious, and Mariachi Estrella developed a following. In July 1981, they were invited to play in Kansas City at the new Hyatt Regency Hotel. Teresa remembers the whole community was proud.
And the women especially, they said, oh, that is good for you, good for you, for a woman to be playing.
When they got to the hotel, they were on their way to change into their costumes, walking across the second-story skywalk overlooking the lobby when it happened. The skywalk above them suddenly collapsed and brought them all down.
I was asking God to help me in Spanish. I said, Padre Santo, ayúdame. And I had already made up my mind that I was going to die, but I said it real loud, and then all of a sudden the man said, she's alive, there's a live one. And the only thing I could move was this hand. And I grabbed his hand, and they lifted it just a little bit, and they dragged me out of there.
Four of Teresa's band members died in the collapse. 114 people died in all, and more than 200 were injured. The skywalk collapse at Kansas City's Hyatt Regency remains one of the deadliest architectural disasters in U.S. history. And in the Little Guadalupe Parish in Topeka, some families drew their curtains and didn't open them again for years. It took a couple of months before Teresa recovered. She had a crushed vertebra, a concussion, and severe bruising. But as soon as she was back on her feet, she started playing for the choir again in church. The music helped her recover, but she had a different focus now.
I know God saved me, and He saved me so I could be a better mother to my family and keep them together.
Mariachi Estrella played together for a little while, but the surviving members found themselves drawn into their families, and each spun off their own groups. Teresa concentrated on teaching mariachi to her grandchildren, and with them, she kept the name Mariachi Estrella. Now her granddaughters are finishing college.
They both said, Grandma, you know we're going to come back. The trouble is, even though they love mariachi music, but they've seen so many things that they want to do. Isn't that beautiful? What has opened up for these two girls?
Maria Teresa Alonso Cuevas died December 12th at the age of 93. She had 13 grandchildren and 7 great-grandchildren. But those two granddaughters she told us about 5 years ago in the story you just heard now find themselves mourning the loss of their musical mentor, just as they released their debut album. Maria and Tess Cuevas were both named after their grandmother. They recently formed a group with a few other musicians called Maria the Mexican. They describe it as Americana soul Mexicana groove. Come right on. Twenty-five-year-old Maria Cuevas says that although the band's sound is wide-ranging, the sisters' foundation is mariachi, and there are two traditional songs on the album they just released.
When we sing that music, it's just, it feels natural, and it's easy.
The sisters studied and performed for 10 years with their grandmother, both starting around age 11. Maria played a traditional string instrument called the vihuela, and Tess played violin. Throughout high school, they performed 3 or 4 times a month with Mariachi Estrella.
Sometimes it was a little difficult because all my friends were going to this party or hanging out, and I couldn't go because I had a mariachi gig.
Maria and Tess both graduated from KU and have other careers, but they're passionate about music and have big hopes for the band Maria the Mexican. And about that name, Maria Cuevas says they want people to ask because they want to talk about their grandma.
I just want to be able to continue to tell her story and have her live on through our music and sort of never forget where my sister and I came from.
Maria the Mexican released a debut album called Moon Colored Jade in November, just a month before Teresa Cuevas died. It includes a traditional mariachi standard, El Cascabel, or the rattlesnake. Maria Cuevas says her grandmother was able to follow the progression of the new band over the past 2 years.
She was actually able to come to one of our shows. She just was so happy, and you could tell. And when we played El Cascabel, she just lit up. And she was telling everybody around her, like, oh my gosh, that music is so hard, because it's a pretty difficult song on the violin. And that was a show. We actually opened for Los Lobos,
And so it was funny because they really wanted to meet her, and they were very excited about her a little more than us. And so, you know, we're used to that. But we were so happy that she was able to come. And then after that, every time we had a gig, she would say, I'm going to come. And we'd be like, well, Grandma, you know, we play at 11 p.m. or 10 p.m., you know. And she's like, that's okay. I don't care.
The band Maria the Mexican has a number of performances coming up in Kansas City, including the release of their album on vinyl at Prospero's Uptown Books on February 1st. That's it for Casey Currents today. Our live broadcast is every Thursday morning. If you missed part of the show, want to hear it again, or get in touch, check out our page at kcur.org or tweet us at Casey Currents. Central Standard Friday is back tomorrow with the best and worst movies of 2013. Next on Up to Date, Steve Kraske hosts a roundtable of pundits talking about what to expect in 2014. Today's Casey Currents was produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Susan Wilson, and Suzanne Hogan with help from Ross Steinmetz. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross, and this is KCUR.